Thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Bob Kinzel, co-host of Vermont Edition. Just wanted to let you know that this has been edited for brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Tomorrow marks the 50th annual Earth Day, and while big gatherings and celebrations have been canceled or postponed, what better way to celebrate than with a socially distanced citizen science activity the whole family can enjoy? Vermont's annual Green Up Day also turns 50 this year and has been moved to the end of May from its normal early May weekend. But there are other things you can do to enjoy, learn about, and contribute to the natural landscape around you. This hour, we will learn about many ways Vermonters are tapping into their inner scientist, observing and deepening our collective understanding of the natural world. Kent McFarland is a Woodstock-based conservation biologist, photographer, writer, and naturalist, and co-host of Outdoor Radio on VPR. Hi, Kent. Nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk with you, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And Brian Pfeiffer is a Montpelier-based writer and biologist. And Brian, it's a pleasure to have you back with us as well.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here.
I normally love being in the studio, I have to say, with both of you, because your enthusiasm is infectious, but we are really trying hard to prevent other kinds of infections right now. So I'm hoping that your enthusiasm will just sort of fuse into the conversation here today. It's nice to talk with both of you.
Yeah, I'm sure it will.
So, Kent.
It's easy with nature.
It is easy with nature, and it's easy with the two of you because you both have so much knowledge, but also so much interest and curiosity and enthusiasm for what other people are seeing as well. Brian, what are you observing and enjoying right now in our quarantine or self-isolation state?
Well, you know, I actually began this process in February before we knew the extent of this virus. And, you know, we all know that Vermont has more than four seasons. You know, there's in addition to the four, there's mud season and sugaring season and black fly season and stick season and rifle season and all these other events that happen throughout the year that we all know and love, like everything from, I don't know, Jazz Fest to the blessing of the snowmobiles in Island Pond. And nature has these similar seasons and these similar big events. And if you're keyed into it, you can follow these many, many seasons in Vermont. And by, you know, in mid-February, we started to see our first spring migrants. And you can forget this notion of, you know, robins and crocuses being the harbingers of spring. You know, turkey vultures start showing up in mid-February. Like, so spring glides in on naked, ruddy heads, you know, and these angled wings. And in March, we start to, the migration picks up just a little bit, the bird migration. But we start to see other things in March, like certain flowers at the end of March start to turn up on our trees. And in these rainy days of April, it's now amphibian orgy season. You know, amphibians are mating in wetlands and ponds across the state right now. And after that, we'll start to see more birds coming in. But what I'm really enjoying now, right now, and it lasts for a few weeks to a month or so, is the forest coming into flower now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and particularly maples, this quintessential Vermont tree. We tend to think of spring as a great greening, but the greening comes later. Like, spring really begins with, you know, to use an overused phrase, 50 shades of red. The forest starts to turn red now. And many folks, well, if you look up into the forest canopy, you will see red buds. The red flowers of red maple and other species starting just now coming into bloom in our forest.
You know, I posted a picture of some maple buds just the other day because we've got a couple of beautiful maples on my property that are in bloom. And somebody pointed out that right now those buds on the maple look just like the very close up of a coronavirus. Which was, I had not thought of it that way, but you're going to go out and look, find a maple tree, go out and look, and you will see it differently, because once I saw that, now I can't unsee it.
I hate that, but, you know, so if you'd rather not look at the maples, the other thing you can do, and this has been sort of my salvation this week, I have to say, is look down at the forest floor, particularly in sweet hardwoods where calcium is in the soils. Often you'll find them in sugarwoods. And that is this incredible bloom of spring wildflowers that is happening now on the forest floor. And these are elegant, beautiful, diverse flowers that get their business done pollinating before the leaves on the trees, leaf out and block the sun, block the forest floor, block the sun from hitting the forest floor. So right now, all over Vermont, we're seeing these just elegant, diverse, beautiful spring ephemeral wildflowers. That's the season we're in now.
Yes, and I love waiting, too. I look every time I go out on the weekends, although, and I'm still in the studio, but for many people, maybe weekdays are when you get to go out in the forest now, and you just wait for that first jack in the pulpit that you see, or the first trillium. You see the trillium leaves, and then you see the flower, and it's like this moment of triumph that you had nothing to do with except you get to observe it and feel that burst of joy that springtime is here. Kent, I interrupted you. What did you want to say?
Well, I was just going to say the other thing about watching these spring ephemeral wildflowers is watching what's coming to them. Brian mentioned, they're popping up to be pollinated before they get surrounded by shade. If you take some time now, and some of us have more time than we ever had to sit around after work in our local woodlot, if you watch some of these flowers, you'll notice a whole horde of bees coming to them. And they're really important sources for these bees early in the season because there's not a whole lot of wildflowers out there. And some of them have really special wild bees that come to them. And some of these bees, when they come, they might look like a little tiny fly, but they're actually a bee. And so if you spend some time watching these wildflowers, you'll see a whole host of wild bees, native wild bees that we share the forest with too.
And Kent, that's actually one of the citizen science projects people can get involved with, because over the years, scientists have been asking for Vermonters' help in identifying different bees and observing bees where they are. I mean, I'm always looking at bumblebees and trying to figure out if I can identify one species of bumblebee from another. And I, sometimes I'm like, that's the rusty butted or whatever it's called, the rusty bumblebee. Yeah, rusty backed. And I've never actually seen one. But people can start to learn to identify our native bees and try to help make sure that they're telling people about the ones they see, right?
Yeah, and the great thing is everybody can do this while you're watching these wildflowers. All you have to do is snap a photograph of these bees. And a lot of them, if you get a decent photograph of them, a lot of them can be identified from photographs. Not all of them. Some of them you really have to have a microscope and, get into the nitty gritty of them to figure them out. But a lot of them can be identified from photographs. And we've discovered in the last couple of years, I think something like 10 or 15 new species for Vermont, just from people photographing wild bees in their neighborhood and putting them on iNaturalist on our project, Vermont House of Life. And then experts like Spencer Hardy, one of our bee guys at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, go on there and they're able to work it out in ID for them and get them down to species. And that way we're really discovering a lot about our native pollinators that were just unnoticed before.
I'm a beekeeper, so different kind of bees, but it always amazes me when we first check on the bees in the spring, one of those first spring warm days, to see them carrying pollen back on their legs and wondering, where the heck did they find that? Because the bees are obviously finding pollen before I can see any buds that are out or any flowers that are out. And so, Kent, you're saying, you can watch these flowers, but you can actually see in some of the pollinators that they are finding things before we humans are really identifying them as buds coming out and emerging.
Oh yeah. Some of these early bumblebees could be traveling kilometers to find resources. The bumblebees we're seeing coming out right now are all queens that have overwintered underground, and they're frantically looking for resources around to start to build their hive up and lay eggs so they can have workers that then the workers can go out and travel and find pollen. And like I said, that could be, they could go 5 kilometers to a source of pollen and back. So they're traveling about, definitely.
Wow. Listeners, go ahead, Brian.
Well, what I really love now that Kent mentions those queens is that there's one of these spring wildflowers, we call them spring beauties, and they are just these tiny, elegant, the flowers look like striped peppermint candy, and there's a nectar disc in those flowers, and the bump, they're just tiny things. And you'll find these things on sunny days in bloom in the woods. And when a bumblebee lands on one, they are usually so heavy, they land on the flower and then they flop to the ground as they're nectaring, because the flower itself cannot hold the weight of the bee. So that's something I look forward to, a little thing that I look forward to every spring.
Listeners, see, I told you, you know, Kent and Brian can get you excited about things that you might otherwise think that you were afraid of, and you know, bees among them, but other things as well, or things that you think of more as pests. But you observe these very tiny things, and you can start to see and have adventures in your own backyard or your own city street. And I want to talk now to Max, who's calling in from Warren. Hi, Max. Nice to talk with you.
Hi.
So, Max, you're in third grade. What are you doing right now in terms of observing and studying the natural world?
Well, last week, me and my mom went salamandering to help the salamander migration, and we helped like 43 salamanders, spotted salamanders, and a bunch of other like frogs and little tree frogs.
Max, you said that you've been helping the spotted salamanders, and I am so jealous because I see a lot of eastern newts, the red ones, in my walks, but I have been dying for years to see one of those beautiful salamanders with the dark blue and the yellow spots, and you've not only seen them, but you've helped them cross the road?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, Max, this is Kent. So when were you finding these spotted salamanders? Was it in the daytime, nighttime? When were you out helping them cross roads and stuff?
Night.
Nighttime, right.
So, Max, what did you learn, or what do you want other people to know about what they can do to help?
Well, if we're not seeing salamanders, it means the water is polluted. And they're super delicate and also very cool creatures.
Max, that's so cool. Thank you for sharing that. Let me ask you one other question. Since you don't have school in your school buildings, if you went to a school building before, do you feel like you're getting a science education just being out there and doing things like this?
Yes, definitely.
Well, Max, thank you for sharing. That's very cool. Thanks. And listeners, you can share as well, whether you're in third grade or whether you were in third grade 50 years ago, maybe, about what you're observing. 1-800-639-2211. Kent and Brian, you know that I am an amphibianophile, and I am desperate to see one of these spotted salamanders. If there are others who are hoping to see newts or other kinds of salamanders or amphibians and reptiles right now, what should they be doing, and maybe some types of spots, depending on where they are in the state, that they could go? Kent?
Well, one of the things is I was asking Max when he went and saw these spotted salamanders, because I was figuring he went out at nighttime, usually when there's a little bit of rain or it has rained, because these migrate in the springtime after there's been, you know, a slight warming spell, and the ground has warmed up a little bit. They come out at nighttime after there's been a rainfall or during rainfall, and then they're migrating towards vernal pools, these big puddles that you find in the woods that last through the summer, where the eggs can grow up and hatch out. And so if you're not going out at nighttime, it's really hard to find spotted salamanders, because that's when they're out and about on the surface. In the daytime, they're hiding underneath leaf litter. They're already at the vernal pool, or the whole summer and even in the winter, they're pretty far underground. They're underground hunting for things in small mammal tunnels and things. So it's that really crazy time right now when you have this little window of opportunity to go out in miserable weather, to be honest with you, and find amazing amphibians like spotted salamanders and frogs and Jefferson salamanders and all kinds of other things. And it's just a tiny window to see that happen.
Yeah. And listeners, you should look in your area, you know, see, maybe reach out on your front porch forum or in another way, because there are a lot of salamander brigades, amphibian brigades in the spring that do help with the migration that you could get connected with.
And I was going to say, there's a great project that Steve Fascio at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies started. And he teamed up with Vermont Fish and Wildlife. the Department of Vermont Fish and Wildlife, doing a vernal pool atlas of Vermont. And so you can go to vpatlas.org, vernalpoolatlas.org, and there's a map there of every known or possible vernal pool in the whole state of Vermont. It looks like somebody just peppered the state of Vermont map with dots. There's vernal pools everywhere. But the problem is a lot of these vernal pools have never been visited, or they've been visited a decade ago, and so no one knows the status of the vernal pool. So you can go on the map and find your neighborhood, find out if there's any vernal pools on the map near your neighborhood, and then go and visit those, take pictures of any eggs or amphibians that you find in the vernal pools, and then report your visit back to the site, and it's logged into the database. And so there's information on the status of these vernal pools going into the future. It's a great way to sort of have a hunt in the woods for a spot in the woods, you know, because you're traveling through the woods trying to find this small vernal pool hidden in the woods somewhere. And then you get to, you know, you get to have the joy of finding, hopefully finding salamanders and frog eggs and things and documenting them with a photograph.
Yeah, it's like a scavenger hunt.
I can add one quick plug also for the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. It's another atlas, a broader atlas, which is, I believe it's vermontherpatlas.org, vtherpatlas.org. And there are more accessible amphibians now. Even in some roadside ditches, wood frogs are putting on a show right now. You'll hear clucking during the day in these little roadside ditches or ponds or wetlands. And these are wood frogs mating right now before your eyes in the daytime.
Maybe not before your eyes unless you're really lucky, I suppose, Brian. You know, and I was hearing the wood frogs before I was hearing the peepers in my area in Addison County anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Peepers are going to get rolling big time soon. They've started in some places. But actually, no, the wood frog, I've got video on my website of wood frogs in what we call amplexus, which is a somewhat unsettling event, particularly if you were a female wood frog.
Well, we'll put a link there for people who want to venture, you know, into that territory to Brian's website. Let's go to Stephen, who's calling in from Marshfield. Hi, Stephen.
Hi there. I've got a question about bird calls. Because I'm out of work now, I don't mind getting up so early, and there was a regular call that was happening outside my window at between 4 and 5 every morning. It was three regular notes repeated over the course of an hour, and a friend identified it as a tufted titmouse. When I go online and listen to recordings of them, it is the same quality of notes, but their pattern is different. Maybe three notes, then four, then two, repeating irregularly. This one bird, it's three notes every time for an hour. So is that typical to fit within a species to have that kind of variation?
Stephen, can you make the sound? Sorry to put you on the spot, but what is the sound you're hearing, the three notes? Okay. So, Stephen, thanks. Brian, what do you think?
Yeah. In fact, even before Stephen, I think, would mention the name of the bird, I had suspected tufted titmouse.
And so you would hear it?
They do vary. Yeah, they will vary their vocalizations. Most often we hear them say, Peter, 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 but they will also utter single notes as well.
Even just for a full hour, just those three notes, you think, Brian?
It's usually not that consistent over the course of an hour, but it could be.
Kent, you agree?
I have the same, I guess I'll call it problem outside my bedroom window too. It's starting way too early, and there's a tufted titmouse pair that are probably going to nest in they nest in hollows in trees, little holes in trees. And there's a little hole in a maple tree right outside my bedroom window that I'm sure they're going to nest in. And the male starting pre-dawn is doing exactly the same thing. Three notes for like 2 hours. It's incredible. At first I was like, oh, spring, great. Now I'm kind of like, really? Can you guys just lay eggs and get done with it?
Oh, no, they're awesome.
No, I know.
Listeners, what are you thinking and what are you hearing and seeing and what do you want to talk about? And if you have a citizen science project that you want us to make sure we're all aware of, please plug it. Let us know. Eve Frankel, who's communications director for the Nature Conservancy in Vermont, says, don't forget about the Nature Conservancy's Nature Interrupted webinar series that's bringing nature to people inside their homes. Wildflowers, wildlife, carbon, and more. Thanks for that, Eve. And Susan in Rutland shares this really cool story, saying, a few years ago, I made a delightful discovery. I happened to be wearing amber-colored glasses on a sunny spring day and found I could see the color of buds on the trees that weren't apparent with the naked eye. They were the pastel version of the foliage in the fall. That's very cool, Susan. Speaking of citizen science projects, let's talk to Corey Miller in Facedon. Corey is executive director of the Friends of the Mad River. Hi, Corey. Nice to talk with you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having us.
So what are you doing and observing in the Mad River Valley?
Well, our work is to bring the community together to steward the watershed's healthy land and clean water. And we're really hoping that we can encourage positive vibes right now by letting people from their homes stay connected together sort of socially by spreading the love of what they see directly out their back doors.
And are you using a hashtag or something? How are you spreading that information and that vibe?
Yeah, so it's our hashtag is hashtag Mad Shed Love. So it's like Mad River Watershed Love. And we introduced it in 2017 for just a slightly different purpose in a photo contest. And now we're just encouraging folks to share photos and videos and stories of the, you know, the signs of spring, like you all are talking about, and all of the stories unfolding outside our doors.
Well, very cool. Corey, thanks for telling us about it.
For inviting me.
That's Corey Miller, executive director of the Friends of the Mad River. And let's go to Merlin, calling from Lisbon, New Hampshire. Hi, Merlin.
Yeah, hello.
Hi. What are you thinking and experiencing with the natural world right now?
Well, I got a little homework assignment for the family that likes to stay together outside. Get yourself a tarp, 10 by 10, 12 by 12. Nail it down good over an open sky. Leave it. Wait a month. When the month is up, take the four corners up towards the center. Get a 5-gallon bucket, preferably white. Get some cheesecloth, also white. And pour the water through the cheesecloth as it's going over the tarp, and what you will get are little black, gritty, like grains of sand, only a little bigger. Do you know what that is?
Uh-uh. Tell me.
Stardust. Literally. It's in your hair. Tons of the stuff fall to Earth every day. And you can go out there and you can stake your claim and you find something that's just a little better than cool.
Well, Merlin, that is a little better than cool. Thanks for that advice. Kent McFarland, there are so many different ways that you can observe the natural world around you. Merlin says, you can actually see this stardust. You and I have talked about other ways that you could use, if not a tarp, a sheet, to like catch moths and see what's flying in your evening sky if you throw a flashlight beam up against it. Lots of ways that people can really easily, with things they have around, find a new way to observe things that they otherwise wouldn't see.
Yeah, I mean, we've got this project going on right now called the Vermont Spring Backyard BioBlitz. It just started on Monday, and it's going to last a month, and it's on iNaturalist. And Sean Beckett and Zach Cota over at North Branch Nature Center came up with the idea with the Half Earth Project folks and invited us to join in on iNat at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies to get everybody for the month to go out and do just that, discover anything they can in their backyard, anything alive they can in their backyard, and post it on this iNaturalist project called the Vermont Spring Backyard BioBlitz. And for 1 month, we're all kind of, a lot of us are stuck at home. So for 1 month, we got plenty of time to sort of dig around in our backyard and find things. And when you start to do that with taking photographs and putting them on iNaturalist, you realize how much life is in your backyard. And you were mentioning, for example, putting up a sheet and putting a light on it at night for moths. I've done that for a couple of years. I'm just on my back deck, and I think I'm up to about 420 species of moths on my back deck.
Whoa, really?
Yeah, it's crazy how much is in you. And I have 0.23 acres, so it's not like I'm on a huge farm or anything. I'm on less than a quarter of an acre. So, you start digging around and you realize how much is to be discovered right out your front or back door. And this project that we've come up with for the next month is already starting to show how much people are discovering. I mean, there's almost 100 people doing it right now, just in day one. And what are we up to? 147 species in backyard so far, which is just, I mean, that's barely even rolling a blade of grass over. There's a lot more to discover. So head on over to iNaturalist, which is a great free application online and a free smartphone app. And you can get started discovering things. You don't have to know anything. That's the great thing about it. There's naturalists on there helping you ID things. And you end up learning a whole lot about all the natural stuff around you.
Well, and that's helpful, Kent, because sometimes I will snap a photo of a beetle and then I'll go online and try to identify it. And, you know, it's sometimes hard even with the bug identification guides where it's like, well, what type of wings does it have? And you can narrow down the field one way. But then I look and I'm like, but none of those look like the thing that I was looking at, you know, and then I start over again. So it's nice to have a place where people who know the information can say, oh, I know what that is. You know, that's an X. And then you've got that information without having to do hours of searching and feeling like you still don't know what it is.
I mean, that is the great thing about iNaturalist and all the projects on it, like our backyard biodiversity project, which is that you don't have to know anything. You can just say, you know what? I know it's a beetle. I call it a beetle. And the next thing you know, there'll be some expert, maybe not even in Vermont. The expert could be in Europe. They could be anywhere. Dials in and looks at your beetle and says, oh, you've got a such and such beetle there. And then the next person chimes in and says, yeah, I found that in the next county over. And then you can start asking them questions on iNat right on the spot. Like, oh, well, how'd you know that was that kind of beetle? Well, if you look at its antenna, it's got this certain bend to it. And, you know, next thing you know, you've just learned something really crazy about something in your back, just in your backyard. And people have helped you that may be a continent away.
Brian?
Well, you know what else is amazing about iNaturalist? And even before the virus, it is truly a community. To the extent that we now have to do what I like to say is, you know, distance socializing, you know, iNaturalist is a genuine community. It is not, there is no, iNaturalist is not there to sell you anything, to make you yourself the commodity. No one's getting rich from it. It's just shared nature. It's shared experience. It's shared knowledge. It's wonderful. It's brilliant. It's easy to use. And it really is the best, I think, that the internet, for all its faults, can offer us in terms of this nexus between us and nature and this time of virus.
Katie Farber wrote in. Katie's a Vermont author who wrote the children's book Salamander Sky about migration and vernal pools. And she's posting photos of salamanders she found. And she tweets, I saw friends and neighbors out in search of salamanders and frogs to help. I patrolled our road for hours in the dark and rain. It was a joy during such a tough time. I was wet and cold, but so happy having seen them. And she adds, the Vermont Audubon Guide for Salamanders is amazing. And let's go to John, who's calling in from Winooski. Hi, John.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
I was wondering if there was like a state identification site on the internet. I think I found one for flowers and plants a few years ago, but there's one I've been looking for, and I can't find the site anymore.
And you're specifically looking for Vermont plants and flowers, or just flowers?
Plants and flowers. Yeah.
Okay, plants and flowers. Brian, do you have advice for John?
I don't know of an official state site. There's an amazing site called Go Botany.
Yep.
And it's run by the New England Wildflower Society. And it is perhaps a bit technical for some folks, but it really is a spectacular site. It's got keys that you can work your way through to help you identify what you're looking at. I would suggest Go Botany.
Go Botany. Okay. And Kent, I heard a thumbs up, verbal thumbs
definitely
up for that.
Definitely thumbs up for Go Botany. Great, great, great resource. Also, again, not to keep harping about iNaturalist, but the Vermont Atlas of Life project on iNaturalist. iNaturalist has artificial intelligence built into it. So as soon as you put your photo on there, it'll suggest to you maybe the top 10 things that it might be. And because so many people are using it in Vermont, we've recruited so many people, over 8,000 people, a lot of our more common flowers and trees and things, the artificial intelligence does a really good job actually of giving you a hint of what it probably is. And even if you're a little bit off, there's so many really great botanists and naturalists in Vermont on the Vermont House of Life on iNaturalist that the thing will probably be ID'd within a day.
Oh, that's
to help
cool.
you. And then you Gary. Can, like I said, you can quiz the person like, hey, how did you ID that? And they can help you out. So it's between those two resources. I mean, you can really, really get going on GoBotany, but then you can really get your own knowledge from other people's help through iNaturalist and the Vermont House of Life.
Very cool. Let's go to Patricia with us from Bennington. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. So I've really been enjoying listening to your discussions. I was actually en route to my daughter's home with three grandchildren, and one is a third grader. So when there was discussions about the salamanders, it reminded them of somebody I'd seen in Florida on another vacation on a spring break many years ago. But so we're going to go out and we're going to search for some over on our property to see what's underneath the leaves, and it's really damp and raining now. Another thing I wanted to do was get some information about hay infusions. My husband and I had done that years ago as students, and really, you know, enjoyed taking a look at what was growing in the pond where we collect it. And so any ideas about that? I asked them to go on the website over the weekend because we were planning to go out tomorrow in our boots to collect some pond water and maybe get a few started in some mason jars and see what develops in the water that we've collected. So I've got a third grader, seventh, and an 11th grader that we're doing planning to do some research into pond water and looking at what grows in our collection.
Well, Patricia, that's so cool, helping your grandchildren do some science education while they're not in school by investigating pond water. That's a very cool thing. Thank you for sharing that. Mary's with us from Brattleboro. Mary, what about you? What are you observing?
Oh, boy. Thanks. Kent and Brian, Kent, I've enjoyed both your writings and Brian, certainly from your blog and email. And hello to you. And
thank
Ruth.
You.
And
hi, Mary.
Also, yeah, hi. I've been going to Hinsdale maybe four or five times a week, and the Hinsdale setback just along the Connecticut River, which is a great sight to watch things unfold, and going with some friends who are just as avid about looking at everything, and it's true what you said about looking up and seeing the flowers and just being absolutely stunned by all of the colors, and then and certainly the red maples, and then looking down lower and finding eggs in the you know, alongside the paths, and I'm guessing that those are the wood frogs that you mentioned, and if so, you know, it's like, when do those come out? And then also just wondering about, you know, the birds that are the ones that are hopping around and scratching the litter. I can figure that they would be finding insects and grubs and stuff in there. But what are the birds that are, you know, poking along the limbs? You know, what are they finding? And so, I mean, it's so early and it's been so cold.
Mm.
So I'm kind of wondering what they're finding in all these places. So if you have any ideas, that would be helpful.
Yeah, Mary, thanks. Brian or Kent, which one of you wants to tackle this?
Well, either one of us can tackle that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll just go with the diet, bird diet thing first. I mean, it's amazing, actually, if you yourself go to a tree trunk or something and just start looking really closely at all the crevices in the bark, there's a surprising amount of stuff in there. And it's mostly things like spiders, spider egg sacs, old caterpillars, cocoons, all kinds of things are stuck in those cracks and crevices. And when if you have a warm day and then it gets cold, a lot of the insects that were flying have to find a place to hide out. So they go into the crevices and hide. So these birds are skipping along on the bark and on the twigs. And they're basically looking in all those little cracks and crevices to find little morsels of insects and spiders to eat. And there's, like I said, there's a surprising amount of biodiversity stuck in those cracks.
And let's go to Lynette calling in from Greensboro Bend. Hi, Lynette.
Very glad to get to you. I don't know if you folks know what Bar Hill is in Greensboro.
Indeed
we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's our nature 500-acre nature preserve, and I just got back from there a couple years ago. A friend and I were hiking up in that neck of the woods, and we heard what sounded like the biggest flock of ducks in the world. And there was a hedge that we couldn't see through. We got to the hedge, and we finally turned around, and there were no ducks there. It was wood frogs going out of their minds. So I went up there today because I didn't want to miss it. But I had heard that there needs to be a big rain, and then it needs to warm. So we're hoping maybe Thursday maybe we can go up and try to find this happening. I also wanted to say, for any kids that don't know what to do with themselves, if you can find a big jar or a fish tank or anything, I've been collecting moss and lichen, and I've been making terrariums, and it is so much fun, and you can learn that different mosses have different names, and I'm just enjoying it like crazy.
Oh, Lynette, thank you for sharing both of those. I haven't made a terrarium since I was a kid in the 80s. Thank you for that memory. And how cool to see those wood frogs. And you know, wood frogs in particular can sound so weird. I have had the experience of being like, what is that? And then, you know, once you know the what you're listening to, it's very cool. So thank you for that. Trevor's calling in from Rochester. Hi, Trevor. What about you?
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Good. I was just going to make a comment on viewing the spotted that I've been watching them in local ponds recently. And if you go out around 11 at night with a really bright flashlight and shine it down into the pond, you'll see them all over the bottom right around this time of year.
Trevor, you are a night owl going out to the ponds at 11 o'clock at night.
Oh, well, what else are we going to do?
I suppose you're right. Thank you for that recommendation. You want to see spotted salamanders shine a light at the bottom of a pond, maybe in the middle of the night. Let's get another thought in here from Amy, who's with us from Weybridge. Hi, Amy.
Hi. So I'm a fourth grade teacher in Salisbury, Vermont. And a few years ago, I developed a book called Naturally Literate. It's a little booklet. And it has all different categories of birds, plants, amphibians and reptiles, flowers, trees, mammals, fish. And I worked with naturalists from across the state, and they helped me to identify the 10 to 20 species that they believed a naturally literate person should be able to identify and name. And then I put it together in a little booklet with a picture of the plant or animal, and it's a checklist that I developed for my class and also for my own kids. Schools across the state are using it, and I've seen a lot of people now that everyone's home at home learning using these to help both kids and adults who are inspiring to become better naturalists. So I thought it would be apropos to share that with you guys today.
Amy, where can people find it if they want to get it for themselves?
You can go. I put a link. It's a Google Sites list. But you could also email me. It's naturallyliterate@gmail.com. But I'll put up the site. I'll send it to you guys via your Facebook page, via your webpage.
Excellent. Thanks, Amy. The guidebook is called Naturally Literate. Thank you for that. And, you know, a good way for people to start to be able to identify, you know, a certain number of species. And maybe your town also has something, or your regional community. I know in my town, somebody posted on our Facebook page recently that I think a graduate student had done a project identifying the key species of Moncton. So, you know, you can find perhaps the key species right in practically your own backyard, which is so cool as you start to learn about what's actually happening right where you are. Let's go to Jessica, who's calling in from somewhere on the road. Very mysterious, Jessica. What do you want to talk about?
Yeah, hi. I'm home now in East Montpelier.
Oh, good. Welcome home.
But I'm calling because I actually worked at Vince a million years ago when I was first becoming a teacher. But the other day, we have an interesting little backyard ecosystem of a pond and a small field and forest. And we saw a really interesting raptor that I've never really seen before.
It had a white head with black going from its eyes into like a curve, a very white chest with maybe just the slightest bits of spots and black wings. And looking around, I kind of thought maybe it's a goshawk because it makes sense for our area. But
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, Brian, you think goshawk?
Yeah, you described a goshawk fairly well.
I don't think I've ever seen a goshawk. That's very cool. Jessica, thank you for sharing that. Appreciate it. Charlie from Twinfield School in Marshfield wrote in to say, I teach high school math and science. My best educational times with students are outside doing citizen science. With students, we monitor our local crayfish as well as the eastern pearl shell mussel. During the days of COVID-19, I am pushing the Vermont Spring Backyard BioBlitz with my students and other science teachers. My inspiration the last couple of years has been the fantastic North Branch Nature Center and their staff. And Kent, you know, this BioBlitz is expanded, it sounds like, statewide, but the North Branch Nature Center has been doing a BioBlitz for years in the Montpelier area. It's very cool.
Yeah, about every, gosh, I don't know, what is it, Brian? Every 10 years they
10
do
years.
A huge BioBlitz?
Every 10 years.
Every
decade.
Every decade they take Montpelier and basically find every living thing and they can in 24 hours. And Brian and I have both done that both times that they've done it, and it's been really
and
great
you know,
to bring –
You know, there's a couple odd things that really strike me about what's happening now, and that is, one, we're moving so much of this nature observation online, which isn't very natural, actually, but it's offering opportunities for people to see things. Like, I will be doing a sparrow identification lecture, you know, on May 1st, and North Branch in particular has done a fabulous job bringing resources online. But then there's another odd thing about all this is that, you know, so much of, you know, the human experience now, like every pillar of society and culture has changed. You know, schools, government, commerce, art, you know, like the way we all relate to one another, they've all been transformed. You know, like maybe for a long time, maybe forever. But the odd thing, and there's some irony here, is that nature is constant. It's predictable. Like everything that we've been talking about today is what we've been expecting and experiencing for decades here. And, you know, nature at this time of uncertainty in our lives is sort of a form of certainty, of like predictability and resilience. And, you know, it's sort of odd to me that even, you know, at a time when we've talked about it here on Vermont Edition, there's this ongoing assault on nature. And yet here we are turning to it in some ways for signs of comfort or relief in this really uncertain time. So there's some odd irony there about all this.
Yeah, yeah, it's really true. And you know, it is in some ways both a wonderful time and a really difficult time. And there's all of these mix of feelings and emotions, and it's all just tricky. But in some ways you can find that wonder and wonderfulness and find the space for animals to be able to be doing what they want, and plants right now with a little bit less impact from people perhaps on their natural landscapes. Although I will say the trails where I often walk undisturbed from other people are pretty full of people right now. And we're all trying to find different places. I have a note from Margaret who says, I have a blue leopard frog in my pond. Is that a genetic variation or an indicator of something about the chemistry of the pond water? Blue leopard frog.
Yeah, it's what we call an azanthic frog. It's lacking its yellow pigment. And so what you do is if you get yellow and blue, make green. And if it's lacking the yellow pigment, the frog will look blue.
But it's not the pond water. It's just something in the frog.
No, I've seen it just a few times. It's not the pond water.
I want to see it now. And then, Kent, here's a note from Dean who says, what is the spring plant that has what looks like elongated tulip leaves? I found it amongst trout lily and trillium this weekend.
Elongated tulip leaves.
Ooh, elongated tulip leaves.
bloodroot
is coming up.
Wait, is he talking about... Yeah, but I'm wondering if he's maybe seeing the early leaves of ramps.
Oh, that could be. Yes, because you often see them among that trout lily.
Yeah.
Oh, just the leaves, not the flowers.
Yeah, right. just the ramps. Yeah. Oh, good call. I like that. I like that one. All right, well, here's another one then from Dean. I took on a gruesome job of documenting turtle mortality on a local road. I think we had over 8 painted turtles and several snakes killed. Last week, a painted turtle was killed. Is this unusually early for turtle movement? Any proven methods to reduce road mortality?
I don't think it's that early. You know, as soon as it warms up enough, they're going to start wandering to find sites for nesting. And there's been actually several papers published over the years about loss of females in populations because they tend to wander farther than the males and get killed, unfortunately, on the highways. So it's been a known problem for a while with females wandering. So, I mean, I don't know of any solution to it other than slowing down in certain places.
Yeah, slowing down is key.
Yeah.
Hey, Kent, before we go, I wanted you to mention the backyard lady beetle blitz because this is something that sounds very interesting, at least to me.
Yeah, the lady beetles, we've lost about a third of the species. We can't find them in Vermont anymore. They used to be really common in the 1970s and 80s, and they just kind of disappeared. But other states nearby, say New York, for example, have done a lot of work using citizen scientists to find some of these lost lady beetle species. And so we want to do the same thing. So beginning with our lost lady beetle project, beginning in May, mid-May, on a weekend, we're going to kick off a lady beetle atlas of Vermont. We're going to kick it off with a lady beetle backyard blitz. So mid-May, we're going to try to get everyone we can to go in their backyards and find all the different kinds of lady beetles they can, take a picture of them, and put them on iNaturalist, and then that'll kick off the whole summer long of everyone trying to, you know, search fields and yards and gardens for lady beetles and see if we can find some of these native species that have disappeared on us.
Well, very cool. I hope we can hear more about it. And Kent and Brian, thank you both very much. What a pleasure, as always, to talk with you.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Jane.